Welcome. I'm John Kiriakou, and this is The Deep State. Here on The Deep State, we go deep into stories that the mainstream media don't want you to know. The Deep State imprisoned me once upon a time. Well, now we're going after The Deep State. I'd like to welcome our guest, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Dr. Leon is a political scientist and a radio host and commentator. I wanted to switch to the conflict in Ukraine. And I want to start off by telling you about some of my contacts in Washington. And I think they're similar to yours. I know a lot of university professors around the city, Georgetown, American, George Washington universities. A lot of them are ethnically Russian and have become American citizens or dual U.S.-Russian citizens. They teach Russian politics and Russian literature and Russian history. They are unanimous in their position that for all intents and purposes, this conflict is over. It's over. Mm-hmm. Certainly, the United States is trying to keep it going to try to sort of sap the strength of the Russian military as long as they can. But the conflict is over. The Russians have won. If there is going to be a lasting peace, the Ukrainians are going to have to concede territory.
Mm-hmm.
Are you hearing the same kind of thing among analysts who follow these things in the United States? And if so, Wilmer, are the policymakers at the White House, the National Security Council, and the Departments of State and Defense getting the same message?
The answer to your first question is yes. Just about everybody that I speak to, whose opinions I trust, say the same thing. In fact, they even take it a step further and say that Donald Trump has grown bored with the Ukrainian conflict, and that they understand it's a losing venture. And that they're trying to figure out a way to extricate the United States from this and basically let Europe fight this fight.
Yep.
That to a great degree, the motivations and the dynamic has shifted. That initially when this thing started in 2024? When did it start?
No, Joe Biden was still president.
Right, 04, I'm sorry, 04. So,
No. What was it? 19, right?
Okay. I can't remember my year.
No. It was after Biden became president. So it was whenever it was, 21, whatever.
Whenever it was. Right, yeah. Right. Okay. That initially the United States, with the bombing of the Nord Stream pipeline,
yes,
and all those other kinds of things, was drawing Europe into this.
Yes.
And creating this whole mythology of, Russia wants to take, put the band back together, put the Soviet Union back together, and take over Europe. Again, offering no evidence to support that position. But now the Europeans are trying to take control over this, believing that ridiculous narrative, and that Donald Trump really wants to get out of this and pivot towards China.
Mm-hmm.
Final part of your question is, I think they're getting the message, but in the administration, I think they're getting the message, but because they have decimated the Department of State,
right,
from all diplomatic history and diplomats, you basically have the inmates running the asylum, it's a clown car, it's a circus, and they just don't know what to do. Because the one thing they can't do is admit that they're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
They cannot admit defeat, but they've dismissed all of the historic knowledge, all of the diplomatic understanding and technique. How in the world is Jared Kushner going to talk to Lavrov?
Right.
How in the world is Steve? No. It's It's a pea shooter at a gunfight. How is Witkoff going to talk to Wang Yi? No. No, that's like me trying to explain things to my dad. No, son, been in this game a long time. Sit down, you might mess around and learn something. So they just don't know what to do.
Yeah, I think that's right. Wilmer, in your view, what would a durable peace settlement need to address beyond a simple ceasefire? Is there something beyond territory in Ukraine?
Oh, no. As I used to say on my show, they need to resurrect the USS Missouri, bring Emperor Hirohito back. This is surrender.
Right.
This is because as I've been reading it and talking to a lot of the experts that you're talking to, there was a point in time when the first agreement that they came to, the accords,
the Minsk Accords.
Minsk Accords. The Minsk Accords were supposed to be the ceasefire that you're referencing. And the what's the woman's name? From Germany.
Angela Merkel.
Chancellor of Germany. Angela Merkel said, we were lying the whole time.
Yes.
So I think in terms of Putin and Lavrov and in the Russian government's mind, we've crossed that Rubicon. Now we're keeping what you forced us to fight for. We're keeping what we've taken because you put us in no other position other than to do so. And how does President Putin turn to the Russian people and say, well, you know what? We're going to give it back.
Yeah.
How does he
in this life or any other.
Why would he do that?
That's right.
Why would any leader of any country that was forced into the position that they were forced into, why would they just say, psych, we were just kidding. You can have it back. I don't think so.
I want to ask you a question about NATO, and I want to tie all of this together. You know, NATO is obviously under pressure because of the situation in Ukraine, and the U.S. and the other NATO countries are providing aid and providing weapons and rockets and radars and you name it. But NATO is under pressure elsewhere, too. It's under threat, really, from Israel. The Israeli defense minister several weeks ago said that Israel's next war is with Turkey. Turkey is not just a NATO member, but it's one of the three largest militaries in NATO, along with the United States and Germany. If Israel were to attack Turkey and the Turks decided to invoke Article 5 of the NATO Charter, the United States would have to declare war on Israel and would have to jump in on the side of the Turks in a fight with Israel. That will never happen in a million years. It would be the end of NATO. Yesterday, with Benjamin Netanyahu in Washington, he spoke privately with President Trump, but then publicly on Fox News about his opposition to a proposed U.S. sale to Turkey of F-35 fighters. And Donald Trump says, it's not up to a foreign leader to tell me what I can and can't sell to a member of NATO. Where in the world is this heading, do you think? Is this a real threat to NATO?
I think it is a real threat to NATO, but for some slightly different reasons, additional reasons. If I remember Article 5 says, and I'll paraphrase, NATO countries will come to the defense of other NATO countries as they see fit. And I think that's the operative term there. So if they want to send pallets of water, they can send pallets of water. They don't necessarily have to engage directly in the conflict. So one of the unravelings of NATO could be Israel attacks Turkey. Turkey invokes Article 5. So basically, Turkey throws the party and nobody comes.
Yeah.
That's.
But then that would be the end of NATO, would it not?
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
What I'm saying.
Yeah.
This could be another. And when I say nobody comes, what I really mean, I'm being facetious.
No,
what I really mean is they don't respond in the manner that they would respond to France, to Germany, to other NATO, to European NATO countries.
Yeah.
And another element of this is with the United States through the Trump administration forcing these European countries to contribute more to their own defense and to contribute more to NATO, Germany, Greece, France, they have now had to pull back on a lot of their social safety net programs.
Yes.
Which has really alienated and angered, look, you know, the yellow vest protests in France, for example, the raising of the retirement age in France, the United States trying to decimate the manufacturing capacity of Germany through the blowing up of the Nord Stream, that these are factors that I think are also contributing to the unraveling of NATO, because as these European countries are having to pay more for their own defense in the Netherlands, in Sweden, they're having to cut back on a lot of lifestyle issues that Europeans have and Scandinavians have become used to living under. And they're saying, wait a minute, what do you mean I got to pay to go to college? What do you mean I got to start paying for my health care? What do you mean I can't retire at the age of 56? They're saying, why are we now being subjected to all of this change? Oh, because you now have to take my retirement income and send that to NATO? They're saying, no. So I think those are some additional elements that could contribute greatly to the unraveling the unraveling of NATO, along with the things that you articulated.
What does all this mean, do you think, for China? The Chinese seem to be very, very patient. They can just sit, you know, we have this satirical newspaper here in the United States called The Onion. And there was a headline on The Onion recently, and it said, China content to sit back and watch U.S. destroy itself.
Mm-hmm.
And it was funny and satirical because it's true.
True.
So is that what the Chinese policy is, strategic patience? Let the U.S. spend itself into oblivion and get bogged down in a never-ending war against Iran? What's the Chinese position?
In a never-ending war against itself.
Yeah.
I think the answer to your question is yes, because as the United States economy is circling the drain, the Chinese economy is, I think it's been pretty stable at around, 6% growth?
Right.
But the United States is at less than 2.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the development of the BRICS and the power of the BRICS, China is basically traversing the world economically, not militarily.
Mm-hmm.
And now I read an article in the Wall Street Journal saying that because of Trump's policies, that companies, American companies, are now looking back to China for manufacturing since the sanctions have been lessened against China. So, yes, I think, plus, and this applies to Iran as well, you're talking 3,000, 4,000, 7,000 years of history.
Yes.
Compared to 250. So China can sit, and they know their history. So they're able to sit back and say, seen this before, saw it 3,000 years ago. You know, Genghis Khan, and they can going across the steppes of Asia. And we've seen this before. We've seen empires come and go. And they all seem to come and go based upon the same impetus or the same motivations. Militarism, rapid expansion, and projection of power beyond your ability to defend it. So they're going to sit back, hold their cards, and wait, because they've been around a whole lot. I keep going back to my dad. You know, he's sitting in the chair reading the paper saying, okay, go ahead if you want to. You will have to come back this way again, and when you do, boy, is it going to be painful for you. I'd hate to be you. It's one of the things that my dad would say. Keep down that road, son. I'd hate to be you. So I think that's what China is doing here. And again, they're diplomats.
Yeah.
Not only they understand history, they respect history, and they understand diplomacy. And the United States is the bull in the China shop. And what was it about 3 years ago? The Department of Defense did the war gaming against China.
Yes.
And they ran 15 iterations and lost every time.
Yeah, they did similar war games against Iran and lost every time. And then they had to go back and rework the rules so that the Pentagon would win.
I asked this to you, but not of you. Don't you think China knows this? Don't you think Iran knows this? Don't you think Russia knows this? I say this to the audience. So they're not afraid. China isn't afraid. Russia's not afraid. I think, was it when Biden sent the Gerald Ford into the Mediterranean?
Yes.
The story that I got was Putin called Biden and said, hey, Joe, why are you doing this? These people don't scare. And oh, by the way, we can sink that thing from here with our Kinjal missile, hypersonic missiles.
Yes.
What are you doing? So they're reading their press clippings. They're believing their own rhetoric. And they're in this echo, I call it the echo chamber of danger. They're in this echo chamber where they're talking to themselves, they're telling themselves how smart they are, but they're the only ones in the room. So it makes sense to everybody in the room, but the reality is y'all are on a serious fool's errand, and you're throwing good money after bad, all the euphemisms I can come up with. And at the end of the day, like the Greek Empire, like the Roman Empire, y'all gonna fall the same fate. Like the sun never sets on the British Empire.
Yeah.
Really?
Mm.
I think it does.
Until it did. That's right. Tell me a little bit about Chinese foreign policy. It seems very simple. Belt and Road seems like a very simple idea. You just spend a lot of money in foreign countries, developing infrastructure to engender goodwill. Is it really as simple as that?
Well, I think it's called, their policy is the win-win strategy. Is that they want to at least project the image of benefit, mutual benefit. Mm-hmm. Now, there are many who will argue that it's not as beneficial as they make it out to be. Okay, I can accept that, but they're not assassinating your president. They're not kidnapping your president. Mm-hmm. They're not stopping oil coming into your country so that your hospitals cannot perform surgery. They're not shooting babies in the head. They're not shooting teenagers in the knees so that you wind up with a whole generation of crippled children.
That's right.
Growing up to be crippled adults.
That's right.
They're bringing manufacturing into the country. They're bringing processing into the, so it's not merely a matter of extracting resources. We'll help to build the processing plant in your country so that you get paid more than pennies on the dollar for the raw material. You actually become a competitor in the world market. So there are a lot of reasons why I believe countries can look at Chinese policy and say, well, if I got to look at the United States and I got to look at China, I'm going to put my money on China.
Well, the Chinese aren't attacking people. They aren't bombing girls' schools and hospitals.
They're not fomenting coup d'etats.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Again, they're not kidnapping your presidents. They're trying to be as, I guess, good of a neighbor as they can be. And again, folks can debate whether or not it's as advertised. Okay, that's fine. But it's a hell of a lot better than the alternative.
Yeah, I think that's right. What about the continued development of BRICS? Should we expect to see in the coming couple of years, let's say, the initiation of talks about a unified currency, let's say, or a unified foreign policy, or completely free trade? What should we expect to see coming out of BRICS?
I think that's going to be a natural development of what we will experience with the ongoing development of BRICS. Look, I think I read a day or two ago that the Saudis have signed another agreement with China to deal with the petro yuan. Mm-hmm. So not only are they valuing oil based upon the dollar, but the Saudis now seem to be hedging their bet, saying, I think there's going to be another currency that replaces the petrodollar,
right?
And it's in China. So I just throw that out as an example of how I see some of this developing. And I think there are a couple of ways that you can look at BRICS. You can look at the number of countries that are members of BRICS beyond Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. There are now about another 14 or 15 countries that have joined BRICS in some form or fashion. But also look at the population that those countries represent.
Right.
That's damn near...
It's 40% of the planet.
40% of the planet.
Oh, there it is. There it is. Mm-hmm.
So I think the answer to your question is yes. And it's not necessarily going to be a matter of talks. It's just going to be a matter of development. Because the Chinese Development Bank, they don't have the onerous, usurious qualifications and requirements that the IMF has.
That's right.
They don't have the usurious requirements that the World Bank has.
Yes.
The World Bank and the IMF.
IMF.
So people are just going to be, I think, naturally drawn. Countries are going to be naturally drawn to that whole dynamic because it makes sense.
Mm-hmm. We've got just a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to ask you about Cuba. We touched on Cuba earlier in our conversation. The Cubans are very tough, very strong people, very independent, and they've learned to not just do without, but to thrive without, thanks to the U.S. embargo, which extends to food and medicine, by the way, as well as fuel. What should we expect to see over the last 2 years of the Trump presidency vis-a-vis Cuba?
Well, let me just quickly couch this in what I think very simplistic terms, but I think is accurate. Whether you're talking about the United States versus China, whether you're talking about the United States versus Russia or Cuba, what you're really talking about, I think, at the end of the day, is imperialism versus anti-imperialism.
Yes.
Russia is anti-imperialist. China is anti-imperialist. Cuba is anti-imperialist. I think that's what's really, when you boil it down to its most fundamental elements, that's what you're looking at. And so what I see, to answer your question, what I see in Cuba over the next 2 years is a hardening of the United States position. And to me, you can't talk about Cuba without talking about Haiti, because I think the policies that you're seeing towards Cuba are the same policies that you're seeing in Haiti. And when people understand the history of Cuba and how Cuba was involved in the anti-colonialism of the Congo, they were involved in the anti-colonialism of Angola. You wouldn't have the downfall of South Africa if the Cubans didn't send troops and defeat the South Africans in Angola. That's what the United States is so determined to resist.
Mm-hmm.
As in Haiti, they cannot allow a successful revolution in the Western Hemisphere, whether the revolution took place 10 years ago, 50 years ago, or 600 years ago. They cannot, as in France and Haiti, and you know, the French throwing the Haitians throwing out defeating Napoleon in
yes.
the 1800s.
Yes.
They can't allow a country to say we successfully defeated the imperialist.
Thank you very much for being with us today. And thank you for watching. This is The Deep State. And remember, keep asking the questions the government wants you to ignore. I'm John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.